Show Me the Science with Professor Luke O'Neill, a new podcast series from Newstalk.
Hi, and welcome to Show Me the Science with me, Professor Luke O'Neill. And this, in our very first episode, we're going to talk about the science of love. I want to know what love is. Now, love is a very, very important thing, of course, for us as a species. Without love, we wouldn't carry on as a species. Every creature on Earth falls in love with some other one. And the main reason, of course, is breeding and to procreate. But of course, the big question is there a scientific basis for falling in love? What does it mean when you fall in love? And can we understand more about this from a scientific point of view? Now, through ancient times, it was seen as a mystery. Why would you be attracted to someone and not someone else? And the ancients, of course, invented Cupid, say, firing an arrow. And then that person would fall in love with you. And of course, there's no scientific basis for Cupid yet. Although, if they find evidence for Cupid, as a scientist, I will believe it. But I suspect that'll be a bit difficult. So it's a big mystery. Why do you fancy someone? You know, what's the basis for that? And amazingly, science has dug into this. And there's some really good science analysing this big question. And the very first place we start is a thing called pheromones. Now, pheromones are chemicals released by other animals and insects to attract a mate. And the big question is, do humans release pheromones as well? Now, one good example is dogs. When a bitch is in heat, a dog miles away can smell that pheromone coming off that female dog and then will go and get that dog and try to procreate. So we know many animals have it, but it's been a bit of a controversial one. Do humans have pheromones as well? And guess what? Strong evidence now that humans indeed release pheromones. And one really good study was, as ever, it's in Sweden. The Swedes seem especially active in this area. They got women to wear t-shirts. And they got men to sniff the underarm of the t-shirt and then rate whether they found the smell attractive or not. Big study, lots of people were studied, so we know the numbers are going to be good from a statistical point of view. And guess what? When the man sniffed the t-shirt from a woman who was ovulating, he found that smell attractive. Now that just tells you something. So when she's ovulating, that means her eggs are ready and the man could possibly fertilize that egg, as it were, and then he would be attracted to that woman. So here we have the evidence now that women, when they're ovulating, are releasing these pheromones. And of course, the other thing was, do women sniff men? And indeed they do. Another study of t-shirts. Men wore t-shirts now and women were asked to sniff them and they could smell certain chemicals in the sweat. And lo and behold, they found some of these t-shirts attractive. What was interesting was if the man was very symmetrical, if his face had symmetry, the woman rated that smell much more highly. Now, why would that be? Well, symmetry actually means good genes. If your body is built in a very symmetrical way, that means you've got good, strong genes. And the woman might want the genes from the man in his sperm, of course, and therefore she finds the symmetrical man more attractive. And in fact, overall, there's been lots of studies on what we perceive as beautiful or not. Now, of course, this can be very subjective. Some people find one person beautiful, another not, and it might differ between people. But again, symmetry lies at the heart of beauty. So again, a random study looking at lots of photographs of thousands of people to rate them in terms of being attractive, and the symmetrical faces were deemed more attractive than the unsymmetrical ones, and that seems to be the basis for beauty. But this pheromone idea, of course, has given lots of hope to people. Could you make a perfume made of pheromones, for instance? And in some ways, the perfume companies were trying to mimic pheromones, and these very musky smells are seen as attractive.
Chanel number 5.
Chanel number 5.
Her perfume. Parfum de Jean-Paul Gaultier.
It's called Sex Panther. It's quite pungent.
And that mimics a chemical called testosterone, which the man makes, and women are probably sniffing testosterone. And a very interesting study was done comparing gay people to straight people. And gay men were inclined to be attracted more to a man's scent than a woman's. That was based on testosterone. So, and then the next question becomes, so if you're attracted to someone, it could be based on pheromones. We're also looking at people's proportions all the time in their bodies, apart from symmetry. So a woman is drawn to a ratio of 10 to 9 for the shoulders to the hips. And this is absolutely built into women. They find men with that kind of ratio very attractive. For women, a man finds a ratio of the waist to the hip of 7 to 10. The waist is narrow and the hips are a bit broader. And again, a man is drawn to those ratios. And this is almost subconscious. So again, we're drawn to these things, I guess. It's hardwired in us through evolution. Now, another aspect that's really interesting as well is we're inclined to be attracted to people who look a bit like us. Now, what that means is we're kind of attracted to people who look like our parents.
No! God, please, no! No!
That seems a bit, oh, that doesn't sound very nice, does it? But it's true. And the reason for this, it turns out, is that if you are attracted to someone who looks like a relative, they may stick around more when you have the baby, if you're a woman, say, and they might be a bit more reliable. So we're inclined to be drawn to people who look like us. And another amazing part is you're actually sensing the immune system of the person. Now, wait till you hear this one. As an immunologist, I find this fascinating. So you're inclined to be drawn to someone who has an immune system somewhat like yours, like they're related to you with their immune system. Now, why would that be? Well, again, it seems to be about procreation. Because if you have a man with sperm who fertilizes your egg, if that little fetus that develops is very different to the woman's immune system, she might reject it. It's a bit like a transplant. Almost. So therefore, you're drawn to someone whose immune system is a bit like yours to stop you rejecting that fetus. And study after study has confirmed this, which is really fascinating. Now, the next thing is then, let's say you are attracted. What happens next? What happens when you fall in love? Well, first of all, what we've known for generations, and everybody will remember, you become addicted to the person that you're attracted to.
You have no idea how bad it gets. I wish I knew how to quit you.
And that famous song. Addicted to Love really captures this. And we all remember this, hanging around someone's house outside. And when you were a teenager, you would divert your way home just to go past the person's house, even though it was out of your way. You might hang around in a nightclub when you really want to go home and you're sick to death of all the noise, but you're going to hang around just in case the person you have fallen for might talk to you, and you might hang around and maybe even, who knows, have something happen between you. So it's a very interesting, it's like addiction. And in fact, what they've done is they've stuck people into these what are called MRI machines. Now, these machines can image people's brains. And they got people into the machine, they showed them a photograph of the person they're in love with, and the exact same part of the brain lit up that lights up if you take heroin. Now, isn't that striking? So heroin, it turns out, makes you feel like you're in love. You feel a real high. And it's kind of piggybacking then a natural pathway that gets triggered when you fall in love with someone. It's called the dopaminergic pathway. So hence, we think it is exactly like being an addict. Now, of course, it's built this way because you do want to, you know, as I say, procreate, and you become absolutely obsessed with the person. And as I say, you hope that your dreams will come true. And that's the first phase of this attraction process. Now, it then moves on to the second phase, which is called attachment. And a different set of chemicals in your body change. And one of them is called oxytocin.
What's called the cuddle chemical.
And this is a well-known sort of bonding hormone. It kind of goes up when a mother is feeding her baby, and breastfeeding causes oxytocin to go up in the brains of the mother and the baby. And it's all about attachment. And equally, when you're in love with someone, oxytocin levels climb, and it makes us feel very warm and fuzzy inside. And, you know, the feeling of being deeply in love with someone involves oxytocin. And then finally, if you're lucky, that sort of phase of the love turns into a long lasting, deeper love. And then our bodies then are fully sort of plugged into the other person, I guess. And that can go on for years, because remember, we do fall in love with someone, and we as a species are inclined to be monogamous, which is very interesting. So ultimately, it turns into this long lasting feeling. Now, it couldn't have stayed at the addiction phase, because otherwise that would be a threat. We can't be staring at each other's eyes for hours and hours, can we? We're threatened then by, say, the saber-toothed tiger might attack us. So that can't go on forever. We need to just sort of go through that phase and then move into the attachment phase, is what that is all about. Now, the other thing to wonder about then is this monogamy, polygamy thing. And again, science has analysed this. Now, what does it mean to be monogamous? It means you are faithful to that one partner. Polygamous means you have multiple partners. And again, from nature, we know some species are totally monogamous and some are very polygamous. Chimpanzees, for example, are highly polygamous. Orangutans are inclined to be monogamous. So where do we fit on that spectrum? Well, humans are called mildly polygamous. There's a great phrase for you. Now, we know this. Some people cheat. is the sad truth of it, although many stay monogamous, and we'd love to know why this is. I mean, biologically, it makes sense for a man to, I suppose, have lots of babies with different women, so they might be drawn to polygamy. Equally, a woman might want multiple male partners because each child then might be slightly different and one might be stronger than the other in a certain situation. So you can see how polygamy could be part of what we are, I suppose. But by and large, we are a monogamous species. And then incredibly, a fantastic science study was done on this to try and explain it in a creature called a vole. Now, voles are tiny, furry creatures. And they realised, probably about 50 years ago, the meadow vole, the ones that live in meadows, were polygamous. They were love rats. They would play around with other voles. Whereas the prairie vole was monogamous. And the big question is why? If I put those two voles beside each other, you could not tell the difference. And yet one is polygamous, the other is monogamous. And amazingly, it came down to a single gene. Now, I love this because it's what we call reductionism. We can explain something that's very complex with real science here. And the gene is called vasopressin receptor 1 alpha. And that is slightly different in the monogamous vole compared to the polygamous one. And it seems to be tied into, again, sense of smell. It seems to be tied into after voles have sex, they get a massive orgasm. And if you have one of them, it's much stronger and you're drawn to that vole instead if you have that gene. And again, what was incredible was they managed to take a monogamous vole and they changed the gene in that vole. And guess what? It became polygamous. And that was the evidence that we have that gene seems to determine polygamy and monogamy. Now, of course, the big question is, do humans have the same gene? And guess what we do? We also carry the vasorepressin receptor 1 alpha. And what's really interesting is alcohol represses it. Now, what that means is if you do cheat on your boyfriend or girlfriend in a nightclub or something and you come home and, you know, your partner's found out, you can say, it wasn't me, it was the alcohol and my vasopressin receptor 1 alpha. Please forgive me. Will that work? Probably not. But there is a scientific basis for polygamy versus monogamy, and it seems to be built into these kinds of genes. Now, hopefully, as I say, most people remain monogamous, and it's in everybody's interest to raise the children and all that kind of thing. So it's a really important trait, I guess. But the truth is, we're mildly polygamous. Now, the other bit that's interesting from a scientific point of view is when love breaks down, let's call it that for a minute, and when you break up with someone, or more importantly, I guess, if you're bereaved, what happens to your body? And again, lots of science has looked at this because it's a very serious thing, especially bereavement, and can we understand more about it? And the big question is, can you get a broken heart? Now, again, incredibly, you can, and you can measure changes in the heart after you break up with someone or when you're bereaved. And the Japanese even have a name for this. They call it Takotsubo syndrome because they've noticed the heart does change a bit during this period of a breakup or a bereavement. And it's a physical thing. You feel it's awful, obviously psychologically, and you feel a real ache in your heart. Now, why would this be happening? Well, it seems as if there's obviously pressure on your heart because of the stress of this. And they think adrenaline is part of it. So when you have a breakup or you're very stressed because of bereavement, adrenaline levels surge and that puts the heart under pressure. And maybe then the heart is straining because of the adrenaline. And again, scientifically, they've shown this. Often if a couple are together for years and one dies, within days or weeks, the other person dies as well. And therefore, that's evidence, I guess. So Debbie Reynolds was a great example. Her daughter, Carrie Fisher, died in the day Debbie had died. So again, and again, it was heart damage that caused this. So sadly, you can die of a broken heart. The second thing that happens, by the way, is your immune system goes down and you're more at risk of infection. So it's a really interesting thing that love then can actually sort of harm us, I suppose, in the long run. And it can be very sad. But it is part of being in love, I guess, and part of being alive. So all of this tells us, very interestingly, there's a scientific basis to falling in love and what happens in our bodies when that happens and so on. And then secondly, sadly, heartache is also a scientific fact. And all of this is possible because of the great work done by many, many scientists all over the world to address the question, the science of love. Yeah.